So welcome. This very nice spring day. So why is it? Aha, now it's fixed. So last time we kind of considered what's going on with closures. So we provided a translation for the creation, for the code C, that is the code which creates closures, and we also provided code for the we provided an implementation of the eval, which is meant to check whether a closure is referenced from the top of the stack, and if so, evaluates it and replaces the reference, the object which is referenced by the value. So that is what we did last time, and we now already observed that this closure code as is might be horribly inefficient because as according to our schemes we would apply it to every sub-expression whose value is not immediately accessed, and that sub-expression could be just a constant, and then creating a closure which eventually will evaluate to 5 is might be not very not very clever idea. So therefore the next step which we have to do is immediately to go for certain optimizations which would improve in a systematic way the code which we generate. So now what kind of optimizations come to our mind? So the first type of optimizations refers to globals. So when in many situations we have to construct global vectors. And that was, for example, when we construct functional values. So we had to collect all the globals occurring in that function and to wrap it into a vector. And the same holds true if we construct C objects. So, and that means if you have a function application, then you would have for every argument to construct a closure, and for every such argument expression you have to construct the global vectors. And that means this seems to be a lot of work. So here, for example, you see what happens in a closure expression. In the closure code, you first have to push all that the values of the variables accessed in E, make the vector, construct the closure, and so on. And now what one could do is, if I have to construct several closures, and then I could, instead of constructing several vectors, I could check whether some of these vectors would be the same. And if they were the same, I construct it only once, and then store it on the stack, and then reuse it. So that is, we might want to share global vectors. And that is, for example, if we do a translation of let expressions, then we have to do a sequence of let expressions. We might have to provide or we might want to, that would be one thing. Another thing is when we have to do several arguments to a function. And another thing is we could, so that is if we would create the global vector once and we would kind of push it onto the stack like a local variable and then use that whenever we need it. And also we could kind of, in some cases, we could kind of observe that all currently our current global vector might be used by the closures which we construct or by the function which we construct. And that would kind of imply that we might want to put our current global vector into the closure, and that means we just push it onto the stack. And that would be the copy-glob operation. So copy-glob operation would be helpful if we want to wrap the current global vector into a function or into a closure. And that is now, on the other hand, you might say that two expressions have exactly the same set of global variables is perhaps a rare event. And that means reusing the same global vector might be a rare event. If it were possible, it is good, it is beneficial, but it might be rare. So, but then we could come to improve the scheme in that sense that we say, okay, so we do, if we are in a situation which, when we have to construct global vectors, say for 20 expressions, which we see in the code, then we construct one global vector taking a superset of all the global variables in any of these expressions. So say the first expression uses x, the second one y, and the third one z, then we construct one global vector with x, y, z, and use it three times. Yes, that might be perhaps also a good idea. So that would kind of, the advantage is that we would have, we would have to construct less global vectors, but the disadvantage is, and that I mark in red, that some of the global vectors then may contain variables which are not accessed. Now, what is that? What is this? Why is this a problem? In our conceptual view, the heap comes with a garbage collector, and the garbage collector would collect all objects which are garbage. Now, what is garbage? The garbage collector does not know the application. The garbage collector only knows references. And if there's a reference to an object, and from another object which is live, then the object referenced is also live. And so it does not know. So if the whole global vector is still live, then also the components which are never used but refer to something else would be live. And that would mean there is the opportunity for space leaks. These are kind of space leaks, and because the garbage collector would not collect everything what it could collect. The question is whether that is really a problem or whether this is not a problem. So we could kind of do this problem, we could fight that problem in that we add an extra mechanism that is for every, we construct a global vector, and then at some point when we find that a certain global in the vector is used last, that we then override that global variable with null. And by that, we move it from the global vector. And that means those variables which are not in a particular expression, so for example, the expression is x1 plus y, and we have the global vector with x1, y, and z. So what would we do? Then we would say, okay, that one is dead right from the beginning, so we override it with null. And later on, after we have kind of generated the code for the x1, then we know x1 is no longer referenced, we can remove it from the global vector. And then there's y, then we use the y, then there will be no further use of y, and then we remove the y. Yeah? By that we could kind of help the garbage collector by kind of shrinking the global vector, and that would be a very useful optimization. Okay, and that is the same thing if you are a smart Java programmer. You have the garbage collector at hand, but you might help the garbage collector by overwriting every attribute to another with null. Given that it is has a class type, if as soon as that attribute is no longer used, which is a little bit dangerous, because if you are conception, perception, what is the last use, is wrong. And then later you might use the attributed but have only the value null, where you might expect it is non-null. So in that sense, it is also a little bit dangerous. So therefore, it's better to let it be done by the compiler. Okay? So that was another interesting point, what we could do. So now let's go for the second type of very important optimizations, which I have now announced several times, which is the optimization of closures. And now let us systematically consider every kind of expression for which we might construct closures and see whether we can improve the scheme. So in particular, we might make a list of situations when we can avoid the construction of closures altogether. And that is the case of basic values. This is the case of variables, and that is also the case for functions. So now you might say this is virtually always the case. So what is the only case where we cannot avoid to construct the closure? Expressions. What? Expressions. So expressions, what kind of expressions?
Combinations.
Combinations by what?
Operators.
Hmm?
If
yes, that would be one thing if you have an operator application or a function application. Because that means for an operator application, this is still debatable because an operator application is typically cheap. But for a function application, this is for sure. We can do, if we don't know the function, it can be anything, it can be arbitrarily complicated. This is exactly the kind of thing which we would like to delay. And for an operator application might cause a runtime error. So if it's a division by zero, for example, if it's a division operation. And so we might delay that error as much as possible, because if the expression is never evaluated, this error will not occur. So therefore, we would not want to evaluate it on the spot. Okay, so now let's see, let's work through the list of situations and see what we can do. So let's, the first in the list was basic values. And as we have seen, instead of constructing the closure, we would simply, in essence, you see here how the optimization works. We simply replace the C code by the V code. And that means the V code for a constant is loading the constant and making the basic object. So that would be the resulting code in the optimization. And we might compare it. Here, if just for fun, I have spelled out what the C code according to our current translation scheme would look like. So no variables. Therefore, an empty global vector. Then we would construct the closure and jump across the V code. And inside here, that would be the code which we have just. This would be the yellow code here. Then we would have the update and then the B. So that is even in the good case. So we would have at least so the extra, if you want to count the extra instructions which we have to construct is this making vector, making the closure, then this jumping, then later we have to do the update. Four. That is four instructions we have to do separate, additionally, and this is in the optimistic case that we have to, that the value is accessed, and if the value is not accessed, then we would have to do at least three instructions, and otherwise we would have to do just two. So in that sense, we gain under all circumstances. So now what is the situation for variables? Let us again start, or let us perhaps start with what we would do in the case according no optimization. In the no optimization case, we would construct a closure. And when it is evaluated, when the When eval is called for that closure, it would just look up the variable. So that is, the closure code would look as follows. For x, we would kind of retrieve the value of x, make it into, put it, wrap it into a vector. This is this yellow thing. Then we put it into the closure. And when we kind of evaluate the expression, the closure, we would kind of retrieve the variable now from the global vector and evaluate it, and then do the update, and that's it. Now, and here you see the simple code which we would get do in the case of what we would do instead. We just push the x. It's interesting, so that this now, this x could, since it is a variable, it might point to a value, or it might point to a closure. So that is, we do not evaluate the x, we just push the reference to x. Okay? So that means if we want later to evaluate the x, we would still evaluate, have to do the evaluation. So this is the most kind of promising thing, that we because here you really gain something. You have just one instruction instead of four for the unevaluated case, and six into in the evaluated case in the when we access it. Okay, so now let's see how the optimization would work. So here is that. So you have an expression with a recursive definition of A and B, and then you later access A. So A is set to B, and B is set to 7. So in the end, A should be 7, and then you retrieve you access A, and that should evaluate to 7. Okay? So if we now use this, let's now use this optimized code, which, because it's a it's a constant here, and a variable assignment, that is an ideal example for our optimizations. So we would alloc 2 for A and B. Then we have this A equals B, means we would kind of have to create the, to generate the C code for B. C code for B is a local variable with relative address 2, and therefore it that would and the stack distance is 2. Therefore, it is 2 minus 2. This gives a pushlog 0. Then we do the rewrite to set the value of A to override the dummy closure for A. Then we do this, load the constant 7, makes the basic object, that is the C code for the right-hand side of B. And then we do the rewrite 1 to override the B. Okay? And then comes the main, then comes the code for the main expression for this A. And that's the, look, is, we, A has relative address 1, stack distance is 2, 2 minus 1 is 1. So therefore, this gives us pushlog 1. Then we evaluate, because we want to have the value, and then we slide. Okay? That's the code. Now let's execute it. So I have just copied the code on the top of the slide, and then alloc 2 allocates 2 dummies, pushlog 1, duplicates a reference to duplicates the topmost reference. Rewrite two. Now I'm a bit rewrite two takes that dummy and overrides it over there, so it has no effect. So then comes the load constant 7, then comes the make basic, then comes the rewrite 1, Okay, so then we have the basic value here. Then comes the push log 1, and then the eval, and that gives the segmentation fault. And so something is wrong here. So you see the segmentation fault, because eval would at some point jump to the code where is to the code referenced to the into referenced here, but there's still the, it is uninitialized, so it's still the dummy closure. So what went wrong? So and it, so there's a little bit of a story with that kind of failure, which I like to communicate here. I'm sorry that it's always the same anecdote of through all the courses. So, but so it was so that when they conceived these optimizations or that kind of closure code, they had a little example compiler and they had a demo and some person, customer, if you like, went to their compiler and tried a stupid program. And when you kind of try a compiler, you always write stupid programs. And I guess the stupid program which was tried was let rec x equals x in x. So this is a typical kind of program which you then write, and you check what comes out. And then some code was produced, and the code was run, and the result should be, what should it be? It should not be non-termination. So nothing should happen. But instead there was a segmentation fault, and people, and nothing is, for a compiler writer, nothing is more disastrous than when the first example which is tried breaks the compiler. So that's kind of the worst case scenario which can happen. And now what is the point? The point is that in this particular case here, when this rewrite one, so that's the problem here. This push log 0 only kind of duplicates a reference to an uninitialized closure, and this rewrite 2 will then kind of overwrite one uninitialized closure by another uninitialized closure, yeah, one dummy by another dummy, which is stupid. So this only works, and then they found out by that, they found out that this optimization scheme must be a little bit, or this code for variables must be taken with a certain grain of salt. It only works if the variable already points to something which is not a dummy. So the variable must be already initialized, only then you can use it. And that can be easily accomplished in that particular case by that you look statically at that code and see, okay, here is a B which is kind of computed later, but you use it before. So since it's a let rec, you could also kind of rearrange it in such a way that you first do the B and then the A. And then everything is fine, because then the B, the dummy object for the B, has already been overwritten, and then you copy it to the that reference, you copy that into the A, and then everything is fine. Yeah, so in that sense, and for that particular case where you have a program like x equals x, so you have a cyclic variable dependence where there's nothing in between, only x and x. If you have that in the let rec, then you might statically see, ask the user, do you really want to write that code? This will not terminate, will never terminate. And then replace it, perhaps the x, by some kind of dummy code which will never terminate, like and that kind of would solve the problem. Yeah, so variable, so the problem is variable, as we have noticed, the problem is variable to variable bindings, and that we might simply rule out these kind of cyclic definitions. and for acyclic definitions order. So there might be variable declarations in that list, but we order them in such a way that those which are whose right-hand side is not a variable, those definitions are treated first. Okay, so that was a little bit of a side remark, and I like this story, and so I repeat it every year. I like that story because it's one of those, an instance of an seemingly obvious or seemingly correct optimization, which is in fact incorrect, or at least it is incorrect in some situations. And that is one of those things that makes compiler construction interesting, that there are a lot of optimizations which one can do, and it's not always, and many of them are obvious, but it's not necessarily true that these obvious optimizations are correct. So that you have really to invest a little bit of thinking in order to make sure that what you do is really correct. So here now comes for functions. So what is the point in functions? So function, so that is a value. And there you already have constructed the global vector, a global vector for that, and have wrapped it into the functional object. Now if you do a closure around, this is a second wrapping, and that will have, for example, there will be no global variables around it. You first would wrap the global vector, the global variables into the global vector for the closure, and then when you construct the functional values, you take you construct the same vector again, but now by simply taking the values from the global vector of the closure, and so that you could, this second the construction of the global vector could be kind of optimized by using some kind of copy glob thing. Then this construction could be improved. But altogether, why when I construct a functional object, there is no evaluation involved. So that means it is essentially the same task as doing the closure, and therefore one can do it directly. Okay. So now let's come. So it comes now. Now having considered these two pieces of optimization, we will come to a third one later. What happens if we now with a full? If we have a full program in a functional language, what would we do then? Again, that is for that we have to fix what are the initial values for the registers, and here we take essentially the same. A point of view as for the C machine, the PC, we assume that that has initially the value zero, so that program execution starts with an instruction at the zero's position in the code area. And that the uninitialized pointers have a value which are, which do not refer to any heap stack address, so in that sense they will receive the value -1. So that is the this situation, and then the expression for which we kind of which constitutes the program that would typically. So okay, so we assume that it doesn't have free variables because we don't know how should the values for the free variables should be. Provided. So in that sense, a program is an expression without free variables, and then the value of the expression is should be determined. So therefore, the code for the program code, if you like, for the expression corresponds to the V code for the expression. And since there are no globals, so the V code is so there are no variables, so therefore we have the empty variable environment, and the stack distance is zero because nothing is on the stack. And just for a comparison, I said we construct the V code. If we constructed the C code for that expression E, that would mean we construct a closure for it, return a reference it on the stack, and do nothing. And typically, if we let a program run, we want to have done something. So therefore, the V code is the right thing. We want to have the value for the program, but evaluate only as little as possible. And then following that code, we want the virtual machine to halt, and that is, therefore, we have this halt instruction at the end. Okay, so now we can do whole programs, and then we should, I also like to make then this second remark, that the code which we have now systematically, which I have shown you with its schemes for systematic generation of code, that these code schemata results in not very nice code. In fact, one might call it even spaghetti code. And the reason is that we have for functions, for example, we have the code for creating the functional value, and inside nested we have the code for the function when it is called, and so on. And the same for the closure. That is, we have always we have a very deep nesting structure and a lot of jumping, because the ordinary flow of control is: you arrive at the construction of the function, you jump across the code for the function, and then you proceed. And only much later the function is then called. Yeah. So that is one thing, and there was some reason why we did it so, because we wanted to have kind of a local form of code generation. That means when we have an expression, then all the code corresponding to that expression should be in one place. But we could kind of disentangle the whole thing by kind of collecting the code for functions in one code area, and do the construction of the functional value, for example, in another one where it is required. So that means that would mean that we have here the code for the function, and when we construct the corresponding functional value, we simply kind of maintain the address of that function and then refer to it. Yeah. So that is, we kind of by that. So we could, for example, collect the code for functions in some dedicated place, say, for example, following the halt instruction. And that would mean that the big advantage of that is that we kind of eliminate the direct jumps across the code, and which we have in this make in that places where we make functional values and where we make closures. So that is the big advantage. There is a small, I would say a small, but still a visible disadvantage, and that means that the code generation kind of require an extra data structure, not only the code which you emit, but also something like a dump, where we kind of dump the code for the functions whenever they, in that way, in that where you dump the code for functions whenever you arrive there. There could be another solution, and that would this one: you create the code in the way we have I have shown you, but then afterwards you have a disentangling phase where you kind of collect all the functions, the code for the functions which you have seen in some place, and remove the direct jumps. So let us see what, for an example, how this disentanglement would improve the code. So here is that little example program which we have seen. So we have two local variables, A and F. A is a constant, F is a function, and then we call F for 42. And so you see here, we start now with the code, the right-hand side for the A, which is 17. This is a constant, and so we even code C for it, for that constant will kind of... So by the way, we can use for this example call by neat semantics, and that since 17 is a constant, the code C for that right-hand side is just load 17 and then making the making a basic object. Then we it comes to the then we have done this. Now we have to do this. So this is a functional value. So the C code for that is again just the same as the V code, and we so it has one global variable. This is the A. We make a push log zero, which pushes the A. Why push log zero? A has a relative address 1. Stack distance is 1. 1 minus 1 is 0. Therefore, push log 0. Then we make the vector of length 1. Then we make the functional value with reference A. And A is the start address of the code for the right-hand side of for the function, for that function. And that is here. So now I mark in blue the code for that function. It starts at test arg 1 and goes to return 1. Yeah. So that I have kind of delegated the code for the for that function to this blue code section and just proceed directly. And proceeding directly means proceeding to the main expression of the let, of the nested let. And that main expression is a function call. So, and since it's the main expression, and that is from which we want to see the value, so therefore it's code V, what we apply to the main expression. That is, we have to mark off a stack frame here. And then we kind of have to create code for the, make the closure for the argument. The argument is a constant, so therefore the code V is the same as code C. The code C is the same as code V. We just make a basic object for 42. And then we have to evaluate the F, because we need to know F, so it's code V again for F. And that means the code V for F is... Now we have, since we have stack distance 6, and F has relative address 2 and is a local variable, 6 minus 2 is 4. Therefore, push log 4. We have to evaluate it to get hold of the value of F, and then we apply. And then we have the value for the whole expression, and then we make the slide 2 to do the garbage collection, to squeeze out the locals which are no longer needed, and then we are done with halt. Okay? And and then from A on, the blue part is the code for the function F. Okay? And if we would have constructed closures, we would have these closure codes even also in this blue area. But there was no need for constructing any closure in that code. Okay, is there a question? So now let's proceed, enrich our language with structured data. Because so far we could only compute with ints. So the results which we could compute were functions, but that is kind of, we can't look inside functions. So it could be only numbers, and that's a little bit boring, on the boring side. What kind of data types would we, is the minimal thing which we would like to have in a functional language? So the first thing is, which you always might want to have, is something, at least for a functional programmer, that is, you would like to have tuples. So just take a few values and combine them into a tuple. And that is what is always amazing to me is that tuples are that imperative programmers have no need, seem not to have no need for tuples. They always have to construct structs. So it's only now that I think, I don't know whether, do they have added tuples to Java 8? I don't know. So it's, so if you, they have kind of borrowed quite some things from functional programming, but maybe tuples are still not there. But I'm not completely sure. But so at least traditional imperative programming doesn't know about tuples. So that is, what is it? So that is, for every array t greater or equal to zero, you might combine correspondingly many elements into one thing, and that would be a tuple. And interestingly, so there's a one particular case, what is a tuple with a single component? Because then you have an a syntactical ambiguity. Is this a one or a tuple with one component? And then the convention is that in these cases, so it's a type problem, because a tuple has a different type than a value, a basic value. So then the convention is, in taken in OCaml and Haskell and similar languages, that there are no tuples with one component. There are tuples with zero components. This is kind of the unit data type with just a single element. And there are tuples with two components and more, but there are no tuples with one component. Okay? So that's the first thing. So actually one should perhaps write k different from 1. And then there, that is how you construct... Yes?
For the tuples in Python, it's just opening parents, number, comma, and closing parents. And it's a single element.
So you have to state the number of things in the tuple, or what?
Just number, comma, end of tuple.
Number, comma, end of tuple?
Yeah. So you basically have opening parents, number, or whatever you want to put in there, comma, closing parents. And I think that also works in this.
No. There's, I don't think so, that there's a comma thing with a thing like that. So the syntax there is simply you have 1, comma 2. And that is a 2 tuple. And you have, that is for an empty tuple. And so that thing is, would be a tuple with one component. And that does not exist.
That's why, yeah, that's okay.
Okay, so, and then the one thing is to forming composite data values. That's one thing. The other thing is how to retrieve the components again. And there are two kind of possibilities how you can do it. The first one thing is to do, to have kind of a selector. So that this is, that you write, if E is a tuple having at least 20 components, then you can ask for the 20th component. So that, well, there's a kind of a little bit of a problem. The question is, no, the question is, where does this, what is the first component and what is the last component? So here, I guess, we take the idea that components are indexed starting from zero. So therefore, the highest selector which you might apply is n minus 1 if the or k minus 1 if the tuple has k elements, k components. So that is one thing. It is a little bit of a problematic thing, I think. So SML supports this kind of selector, and perhaps you might use that in an untyped setting, but you have a problem typically with it in a typed language, because it's difficult to say what is the type of that selector. And why is it difficult? Because it's somehow polymorphic in the argument, but not quite. So it should be a tuple, but a tuple of any length, of any sufficient length. And that is difficult to express as a type in the ordinary type systems. You could help it in such a way that you kind of never have this operator as a standalone thing, but only as something applied to another expression. And then in this situation, you might determine the type of this expression E, and then you may check kind of separately whether this is a tuple of sufficiently many components so that the J, which is a constant, is less than the number of the components, and then everything is fine. So in that sense, you could kind of deal with it, but you cannot have this operator as a first-class citizen. You can only have it as an operator where the argument necessarily is provided. So this is one choice which one can do, and as I said, that choice is similar to what people do in SML, and in OCaml they don't kind of, I think they don't have it. At least it's not in the ordinary syntax available, but there the natural thing to do is to use kind of pattern matching. And that is, you have here, you introduce a let statement, for example, where the left-hand side is not just one variable, but just a tuple with variable components. So in the real world, you would even have the possibility for some components to provide values, so 1, 2, 3, for example, and then the E, when evaluated, should have in the in those components also these values 1, 2, 3, and that means such a pattern could fail. Then you would have such a pattern matching could fail, then you would have a match failure. But here, for simplicity, in our minimalistic setting, we don't consider cases where you kind of have such kind of match failure, but therefore we assume that the left-hand side here is a tuple of variables only. So that means the x0, then will the 0 be the zeros component of the E1 and so on. Now let's see how we construct code for that, all that stuff. So the first thing is, what do we do for... if we want to construct a tuple? So that means in the code we find expression E0 to EK minus 1 and then round brackets around, and we want to know what do we have to do. And so that's the first thing. What would we do? Well, we kind of may take the point of view. So in a call by need environment, E0 to EK minus 1 need not necessarily be accessed. So we create closures for these. And then we kind of have to provide an object, an element in the heap representing the tuple. And now we could kind of invent a new data element to represent tuples. But instead of using that, we could also simply use the vectors which we already have in our heap. And so we just make a vector of that length and return a reference to that. Yeah? So that means tuples are represented by vectors. Okay, so that's easy. So that was not a difficult thing to do. Now let's see how we retrieve the jth component of a data element of a tuple. So that means if we want to have the code V for that selection, we do first the code V for the E, because we can retrieve the component only if the tuple is evaluated to a value. And then now, how do we access? Now we have to access the J's entry in the vector. We have not yet any instruct possibility, no instruction at hand. So we invent a new instruction. This is this get J, and that could be now. This is a reference to something. We don't know whether it's a closure or a value. So therefore, we have to continue with an eval, and then we have the value. That was the situation when we have a call by need language. When we want to have, when we have a call by value language, then everything is again much simpler, because here then we would not have a C but just V. And here we can skip the eval. Okay, so here is now this get J instruction. It simply takes the J's value out of the vector and pushes it on top of the stack. So that's, and we could kind of make it a little bit more smart by checking, doing kind of checking whether this J, the selector, is admissible in that sense, whether it accesses a component provided by the tuple. Now that is, if you have a typed, if you have a strongly typed programming language, that situation might not occur, and then we can safely skip the runtime check. But if you have an untyped language, if you might want to have arbitrary tuples and arbitrary selectors, then and leave it to the programmer that everything is fine, then we better insert that runtime check. Okay, so that's, in that sense, this selection was also not so difficult. Now let us see what we would do in case, how this inversion would, by means of pattern matching, how that would be implemented. So that means we could have a let definition introducing simultaneously variables y0 to yk minus 1 as the and where their components receive the corresponding components of the e1. So how would then the code be for such an expression be? So first we would have to evaluate the e1 to a value. So therefore we have first to create the code V for E1. And that's clear. We cannot access all components if E1 is a closure. So then now we have to as a result, we expect a reference on top of the stack pointing to a vector in the heap. And now all the components from the vector should be pushed on top of the stack. So for that we need an instruction because we yet have no possibility to do that, simultaneous pushing of all the components. Therefore, we create a new instruction now, get vector. So we did not have that get vector. Yeah, we did not have that that instruction at hand before. And then, having done that, the stack has grown how much? I claim the stack distance has increased by, in fact, I'm a little bit, yeah. So the code V, so here, so think of that. So that's the situation. And that was the stack distance. So the code V of E1 has pushed another reference to that vector. And the vector has length k. And here are k elements. And then this vector here, this reference to a vector is replaced by by the k references. So that means those things here go away, and here on top of the stack we push something, we push k references. So therefore the stack distance has increased by k. And that is the situation when when we start to execute the body of the let. That is the code V for E0. And this code V for E0 addition, so that therefore stack distance plus K. But also we kind of have to take into account that now we have a new address environment. Why? Because we have introduced new local variables, namely the local variables Y0 to YK minus 1. These must be added to the row, and these are the, this gives us, giving us the new address environment row prime. Okay. Now let's see what this get vector thing does. So the get vector thing first. So the this one corresponds to the y zero that should be pushed first, and this one is the y one. This should be pushed next, and so on. So that in this sense, get vector pushes all that these elements on top of the stack. And note again that we would have to if we generate a if our code generation produces an instruction such as get vector k, we better make sure that the object referenced on top of the stack should be a vector of length k. Otherwise, it doesn't make sense. So that means we would have to check whether really on top of the stack we have this such a vector. And if so, we can proceed as indicated. And otherwise, we would have to give some kind of reasonable error message and quit. So, once again, if we have a smart type, just an ordinary type checker, then the type checker would infer that this E1 is a tuple of length k and could it is a tuple, tuple type, and would compare it with the number of components listed here. And if they do not agree, then the type checker already would complain. And if the type checker does not complain, we can be sure everything is fine. No check is required. Okay? So, tuples are nice and, in fact, are completely sufficient in case you have an untyped language. So, in Lisp, essentially, you could think of that you have this just at least in the O. In the kind of the minimalistic Lisp, only has a pair, and that's it. And with the pair, you can do everything. But in typed languages, you kind of distinguish between pairs and lists. So lists are things where you have an empty list, and you have a pair of an element and a list. And you make sure that all the elements in the list have the same type. Yeah, and usually you have then two constructors provided for these two kind of constructors. You have constructors provided for these two things, and syntactically there is always a little bit of a choice how you denote it. So in OCaml, the empty list is just opening followed by closing brackets. And I guess that's the more or less also the same in Haskell. And then for the constructor, you have this double colons. And that is the design, the syntactical choice in OCaml. In Haskell, for example, you have a single colon only. And the reason is well, I don't know why. I guess they wanted to have a separate syntax, and so they decided for that. There's one more thing, because typically you have the possibility, you have another use for this double colons, and that is for when you kind of want to assign an expression a type. And so in OCaml, this is expressed in that way. You can say x is of type int. And in Haskell, now the single colon in Haskell is already a single double colon is already used for the construction of lists. So in Haskell, you would have therefore, you must use that. So in that sense, it's kind of a swap of two things, syntactical things, which makes it a little bit confusing, perhaps. Okay, so then that's this thing, and there's perhaps one more thing. We will kind of encounter it later in examples, but I may already write it here right away, and that is, there's kind of a short notation if you want to express, if you have kind of things 1, 2, 3, 4, and would put want to put all these things in one list, then in OCaml you have to do this semicolons in between and have to put these square brackets. I guess in SML, and I think the same choice in Haskell, is that you do not have that. You only have that. Sorry for these kind of things, but that is kind of the syntactical differences which they have in different languages. And if you write that, this is legal OCaml also, but that what would that mean there? What would that mean in OCaml? This would be a single element list. A single element list containing one tuple. Because you can leave the outer brackets, and the comma indicates that you have several components of something which you join together. Yeah. So in that sense, this is if you make this confusion with this semicolons compared to commas, then you might experience surprises. Okay, so that was about deviation into syntax. Now let's see how we would write the most trivial program which you kind of may write about lists is you have two lists and want to append them, concatenate them, and that is typically expressed by a function like that. You have two arguments, L and Y. And Y is the second argument, L is the first argument where the recursion goes over. And when it's the first argument is the empty list, then you return the Y. And if it's a non-empty list, then it has a head and a tail. Then you append Y to the tail and put H in front. Yeah, and you see here this is a recursive definition of up. So this is not a... You might make it a fuller OCaml expression by letting a rec here and using it in some expression down here. And then there is this. Now what goes on if you have such a function definition? Then you have to inspect the first argument, which is the L, and have to check, is it an empty list or is it a non-empty list? And if it's a non-empty list, if it's an empty list, okay, then you do something. If it's a non-empty list, you require access to the components. And that is, in functional languages, they provide this pattern matching with this keyword match. So this match expression. And this allows to compare a composite value like L with different patterns and by that obtain access to components. So you can use this match expression also for int, for basic types like int, and then it corresponds somehow to the switch in C. But in that sense, it is more general, as you can also apply it here, where it allows you to decompose values and get hold of the components. Yeah. Okay. So in general, this match expression could be done for. So this match expression could be applied to expressions E here, of any type. But here we will consider it only for lists, and only where the patterns with which this selector expression L is compared with only these simple forms where it's empty list or non-empty list. Yeah. So in this sense, we have a restricted language here. You could think of more elaborate pattern matching as well. So here is the syntactical elements we require to program with lists. So we need new syntax to construct lists. So these are these two pieces, and we need this match expression. And then that is for the syntax of the language and perhaps the semantics. Now then we also have to care how do we deal with list objects in our implementation. And in the implementation we require to provide heap elements in the heap for these things. And so we have not yet, so it's not so clear what we could use. We could again use this vector thing and use an empty vector to represent the empty list and a vector with two elements for the non-empty list. We could do that, but here I prefer to provide two separate elements. So that means we have an extra list element for the empty list, so it has here the name of the constructor, if you like, the nil, and we have another list element, this one, with also the name of the constructor here, and the type of the type here, and the components of the list here. So a non-empty list has two references inside. And now, let's see how we construct generate code. So the first thing is, how do we generate code for the empty list? And that's very simple. We don't know how to do it. This is one of these cases where we quickly invent a new instruction, and I call it nil. And the same holds in a similar situation we have when we construct a non-empty list. So we have this operator cons, and two arguments, E1 and E2. And clearly we have to evaluate first E1, then E2, and then construct a list. For the construction of the list, we don't know how to do it, so we invent a new instruction. And for the arguments, E1 and E2, if it's a call by need environment, we would create a closure for the E1. We would not evaluate it. Why should we evaluate it? We construct a closure for it, and we also construct the closure for E2. And please note that when we construct the closure for E2, stack distance has been increased by 1, because the reference to the closure of E1 has been pushed on top of the stack. And in this green area, this code C would be replaced with code V if we are in OCaml. Because then we would evaluate the components before we apply the constructor. And now here are the implementation of the two new instructions. So here is the nil thing. What does it do? It just pushes on top of the stack a reference to a new empty list. And the cons thing is also not so difficult. It expects two references on top of the stack, namely a reference to the head and a reference to the tail. So this is head, this is tail, and so this is head and this is tail. So it expects these two references. It creates the corresponding corresponding list object element in the heap, and then leaves on top of the stack a reference to that new object. Okay, so you see that was is kind of now meanwhile a little bit of a routine matter. Let's see what we can do with pattern matching, whether that poses extra challenges. And so if we want to create generate code for that and create the corresponding code generation scheme, what would we have to do? So we again have to do a collection of the tasks which have to be done to be accomplished in order to realize that expression at runtime. So the first thing is clearly we have to evaluate the E0 to a value, because only then we can compare it with cons and with an empty or non-empty list. Then we have to do a comparison, and that's kind of like a test for zero. Yeah, if it's zero, then we kind of jump, and if it's zero, yeah, then it's false, then we jump, and otherwise we kind of proceed. So here it means it is somehow the same. If it's a non-empty list, then we jump and execute this one. And if it's an empty list, we simply proceed and evaluate the E1, execute the E1. And please note, this executing the E1 is simple because nothing must be done. But if we jump, we have to do a little bit more. We have additionally to push the references to H and T on top of the stack. So accordingly, here is the code. So we call the code V for an expression E in an address environment row and stack distance SD. What would it do? It first evaluates code. We have code V for the E0. That's the first thing. Then we have to do this comparing with empty and non-empty list, and that for that we provide a new instruction. This is this T list A, and A is the start address of the else part, which means the composite case. And then so this kind everything is hidden in there, and so that means it follows the code for the then part, which is the code V for the E1. Yeah. So please note that this T list A should kind of eat up the reference to the E0, to the value of E0, and so that that the code V for E1 then is executed on the plane with the same stack distance as the stack distance of E. And then once we are done with the then part, we again do this unconditional jump behind the else part. Now for the else part, we kind of generate code V, the code V sequence for E2 with the stack distance, though, has been increased by 2. And the reason is that the reference to the H and to the T have been additionally been pushed on top of the stack, so therefore stack distance has been increased by 2. And also this address environment is no longer the one of row, but a row prime, because we have added the local variable H and the local variable T. Yeah, and after we are done with the two alternatives, then after we are done with the evaluation of the E2, then we go out of the local variables H and T go out of scope. Therefore, we have to add a slide 2 to move down the value for the alternative for the composite alternative, and then we may proceed with B. So here is now what this T list A should do. So it takes the reference on top of the stack. So here it is. Then it checks whether that is the H points to a list object. If this is not the case, we have an error. If it is a list, then we check whether it is an empty list. And if so, everything is fine, and we simply pop and continue. Else, on top of the stack, we have a list object which is not an empty list, so it must be a constructed list. And in that sense, if it is a constructed list, we push the two elements inside on top of the stack, and we push this, the two things on top of the stack, and then the stack pointer must be increased by one, because we have, instead of one reference, we now have two references, and additionally, we jump to A. So this test arc, this T list A instruction itself is will provide the bindings for the H and T, so that when we arrive at the address A, we can be sure that H and T have already been pushed on top of the stack, and we can simply proceed with two more local variables. Okay. So let's see. Now we have these. We have seen how list the concepts, the syntactical constructs for lists can be translated. So let's therefore now see how the up function is translated. And we do it in a call by need environment, and we use, just to make the code more readable, use a disentangled version of the code. So here's the body of the function up. And inside the function up, we have an address environment where up is a global variable. And so, therefore, this up is mapped to global, to G, 0. Now let's proceed with our code. So that the body of the up function has two arguments, so therefore test arg 2 at the beginning, and it returns with 2. And in now it comes to the, we have to do the body of the up function, and that there it's this, the body of the up function is a match expression, so we have to evaluate this L. So that's the expression where the match does its case distinction on. So that is that we could also list down here. So what is L? L is the leftmost of the two arguments, so therefore that has a relative address 0, and it's a local variable. And then we have the Y, which is also a local variable, and it has relative address minus 1. Okay? Now, so let me kind of, so that closing bracket is still not there. Okay, so now let's see how we proceed. So we have to get hold of the L. So this L has relative address 0, stack distance is 0, therefore push log 0 minus 0 is 0. Then we evaluate it, because we get hold of it. Then we do this test arc, this T list, A. And A is the address of the composite case. And we proceed with the empty list case. In that case, we return the Y. So we have to get hold of the Y. Stack distance is again 0. Y has relative address minus 1. 0 minus minus 1 is 1. So therefore, push log 1. Then we evaluate it, and then we jump to the end of the match expression, and that is to B. Yeah. So this B here goes to the end of the to the instruction after the match expression, which returns the result. Okay, so that was the then part. Now let's go to the else part, that the composite part. The composite part, so this is this H. Here we note that the stack distance when entering the composite case is 2 because H and T have been pushed on top of the stack. So that means in this case, I kind of may continue. Here the H will receive relative address, so it will be mapped L to L comma 1, and the T will be mapped to L comma 2. Okay, so now we are in this in that case where we have to push the reference to the H. So H is 1, stack distance is 2, 2 minus 1 is 1. So therefore, we have a push log 1 here. Then we have to do this push log 1. Okay. So that is the reference to the H. Now comes the cons. We have to create a construct object, a constructed list object, and then we have now to push. Before we do the constructed list object, we have to do construct the closure for the second argument. The second argument has, now we have to check what kind of variables are inside the second argument. So the second argument is this up applied to tail and y. So we have to push a reference to the up. What is up? Up is a global variable. So we push the a reference to the global variable. Then I said the next thing is the T and then the Y. The T is a local variable with relative address 2. The current stack distance is 4. So therefore it is 4 minus 2 is 2. So by that we push the T, and now comes the Y. So stack distance has now already increased to 5, and Y is relative address minus 1. 5 minus minus 1 is 6. So push log 6 pushes the Y. And then we make a vector of all these three things, and then we make the closure of all these things, and this gives us the second component of the list object, which we construct here. Now we have constructed the list object, then we give up the two local variables and return. Okay? So you see here the up function will not necessarily append the function, but will just return either the empty list or a cons object and closures for the argument. Closures for the argument. So now let's see. As a disentangled, so I now remove all that. Now comes this blue section. And that blue section is the code executed when the closure is evaluated. That is when we evaluate when the closure is evaluated. The right closure is evaluated, not the left one, but the right one, which is for the application of up to T and Y. So this application, in order to do it, we kind of first mark off, it's an application, so we mark off a stack frame. Then we kind of have to push the arguments from right to left. So the Y is the rightmost argument, this is the second global. Then we push the T, which is the first global, and then we push so these are the two arguments. Then we have to evaluate the function, which is the up. Up is a global variable with index 1. We have to get the value of it, so therefore, which means we have to evaluate it. And then this hopefully gives us a reference to a functional object. Then we can apply. Now this application will return the, hopefully, a reference to a list. And then we have this update to override the closure. Okay. So you have seen that how we deal with lists. And it was a dedicated code for a list data type, where because we, as you have seen, we have the heap objects which we provided for lists contain the names of the constructors and the name of the type. And clearly, we could kind of use a similar strategy for user-defined data types. And user-defined data types could have more than two constructors. In that case, if they have more than two constructors, the pattern matching might be a little bit stupid. Here we used kind of as a paradigm for the case distinction, the if then else, because there was the nil case and the non-nil case. If I have a case distinction over a type with 20 constructors, it might be beneficial to have kind of a switch so that you use the name of the constructor as an index. So you kind of might provide, the front end might provide numbers for the constructors, and then you could use these numbers to directly jump through a jump table to the alternative. And in that case, so that would be what one would have to do there. Yeah. And so it is a useful exercise to come up with a nice scheme to do this, to deal with this multi-constructor case and to implement the corresponding switch instruction. And in particular, this scheme should take into account that different constructors have different sets of variables, and so that means you have to, you jump to the alternative, and then the code there now should know how many variables are required, and retrieve them out of the object. And in that sense, it's a little bit specific, because that means that the switch should not eat up, either should duplicate the reference to the data element in the heap, or should not eat it up, because you need require the reference to that object in order to retrieve the components. So it's a nice exercise to dream up a corresponding translation scheme, a code generation scheme. For today, I would say we are done with it. Perhaps one more perspective. Next time we check. So what we have looked at for tuples as well as for lists, the code V, and we might reconsider for these composite data values how the corresponding code C schemes should look like, and that we discuss tomorrow. Thank you for your attention, and we meet again tomorrow at 10:15. Thank you.